Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. The program is number 767, and it is August the 18th, 1986. Just to begin the program with two Reaganisms of the week, because there are so many, we'll never catch up on them. One, in a radio speech July 26th, just about a month ago, the president said, quote, "When we came into office on a hot summer day," well, we didn't come into office on a hot summer day. The economy had about as much energy as a hound dog on a hot summer day. You might remember inauguration is January the 21st, 1981. Also at a high school commencement in New Jersey, he said there are advantages of being president. The day after I was elected, I had my high school grades classified top secret. Well, no wonder he did, if he didn't know whether it was warm or cold on the hot summer's day when he came into office. Now, I'm going to put off for a few weeks some lot of material. It would take an hour to list the important things that I have to put off, but I will be continuing on the Sikhs and their moving large numbers of them to Ecuador, their relationship to drugs in Afghanistan, the CIA, the Pakistan, and the Mossad. I'm going to do a great deal on Anita Costello, Nancy Reagan's drug, not drug running, but weapon smuggling into Paraguay, the weapons and translator for people sending 50,000 rounds of .22. That's a typical assassination weapon, so you could kill 50,000 people with what was shipped on the boat just that particular time when they were apprehended. I also want to do quite a bit on the Beverly Hills connections of Hugh Skinner, the manager of Van Cleef & Arpels, and his murder, Roy Cohn and his relationship to that Beverly Hills milieu, Larry Flynt's mystery illness, Althea Flynt's AIDS, Aja, who now allegedly has TB and the links of TB to AIDS, and Roy Cohn and his AIDS, and of course Roy Cohn from Lionel Train Company, as well as Western Ghouls, mentioned throughout the Permadex document as part of the team that killed John Kennedy. Also, we'll get into the fourth shuttle and the transfer of the shuttle to the military, the Pope coming to Carmel, the Tom Pappas CIA Agnew connections to Watergate and William Rehnquist, the Chernobyl accident, which was man-made and I believe was sabotage, a lot on advanced genetic sciences, and they've been given up the idea of ever coming to Monterey County. They were chased out. And more on the Christic Institute and the lawsuit that involves some very famous and infamous people like Theodore Shackley and John Singlaub, the who's who of the CIA, and the articles that have been coming out since that are very important. So there's a lot of material that I hate to pass up, but I will give you the address to the Christic Institute that is handling this lawsuit. Very important. It's run by Daniel P. Sheehan, S-H-E-E-H-A-N. The Christic Institute is 1324 North Capitol Street, Washington, D.C., 20002. And you can send a contribution or ask for literature, any amount that you want, or up to 25, and then you go on up. You can give what you want. But Mr. Daniel Sheehan refers to this lawsuit that they have against these top CIA people and Contras and Somoza Army teams and assassination teams and agent provocateurs. He compares it similar to the Watergate, and he said, if the suit goes through their project, it could lead to the impeachment of the Reagan administration officials for criminal activities. Well, that would have happened with Lyndon Johnson if we had investigated the Kennedy assassination. It would have happened with a real impeachment of Richard Nixon and the team around him if we had followed it through. I don't know where these big lawsuits ever end. It's similar to the ACLU versus Western Ghouls in Los Angeles that has been silenced for 2 years. I hope they can proceed with it, but they really have a lot of biggies. And it is true that if this were done properly and the lawsuit had enough money, and you can't compete with the unlimited money of the Defense Department and the CIA, but I won't say never, it could actually lead to the impeachment of the Reagan administration and get rid of William Casey and those people that have been there since the OSS days that have gotten it into so much trouble. You might have read in the newspaper today about the members of the death squad, three members of the El Salvadorian death squad, known to kill over 300 people just recently, came to Washington, D.C. to get some more training. And they are trained in the United States as well as elsewhere, and then they're sent back to kill. But I do want to do the entire evening just on William Rehnquist. The appointment of him as a justice of the Supreme Court was horrendous, but now Ronald Reagan has nominated him to be Chief Justice, and I want to deal entirely with that matter and some very important items. And I hope maybe you'll make copies of these tapes and make notes about this, or send for the not the transcript, but the printed sheet with the bibliography sources, and write letters in the next 3 weeks. Congress has a vacation for 3 weeks. This is your chance to participate and jump into the action. When I jumped into the action and confronted the power of Roman Haas or I.G. Farben or the Swedish and the Belgium money and behind Advanced Genetic Sciences, they got a wallop in Monterey County and closed camp. And even now in California, there's a question about their using the altered virus, the bacteria, to put on plants, the ice mine, as they call it. But it's much more dangerous. And they did leave this area with their head down between their legs, and now they're being chased out of other areas. And there are about 20 important articles on that subject just this past week. But we made history in Monterey by kicking them out of Monterey and calling attention to the world, to the huge corporation and the possibilities that it could portend. Now, William Rehnquist was the Justice Department's chief legal advisor from 1969 to 1971. And that was the time period preceding the Watergate arrests. The Watergate crimes that followed after the arrest as of June 72 pertained to the things that were happening and the scandals that were happening when William Rehnquist was the advisor over John Mitchell or Robert Mardian, the lover of the Gestapo photographs in the archives, or G. Gordon Liddy with his Gestapo affiliations and love of the German, actual German Gestapo, and E. Howard Hunt and James McCord and Charles Colson and so forth. He was the Justice Department's chief legal advisor, and several weeks ago I ran down what was happening in this country in 1970 when Richard Nixon decided in 1971 to give the chemical and biological warfare area at Fort Detrick to Litton Industries, and it included Kent State, and I listed for about 15 minutes the various activities. If you have that sheet, if you don't have, write to me, and I'll send it to you. What was happening when Rehnquist was the legal advisor of the Justice Department for the Watergate people that got into so much trouble. Now, in the fall of 1971, October 18, 1971, Louis Tackwood had a press conference, and this is very important because Rehnquist was there, for, as I say, through the time period of 1969 to 71. So what Louis Tackwood was talking about in his press conference, that was the basis for my article, my first published article, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? What he was talking about was plans that were made when William Rehnquist was a legal advisor to the Justice Department, and that is very important, and those are the papers that should be made available. Louis Tackwood had worked for the Los Angeles Police Department for 9 years. He was an agent provocateur. He was assigned to a special squad composed of police and federal agents, and they were to hire radicals and provocateurs for the Republican National Convention in San Diego. This Christig Institute, the suit that they have, is about Asian provocateurs bombing the American embassy in Costa Rica and blaming Nicaragua and creating violence as an excuse to overthrow the government in Nicaragua. It's the identical thing continuing on in 1964. This was 1971. Squad 19 was coordinated as a contingency plan under the joint direction of the FBI, the National FBI, the CCS, the Criminal Conspiracy Section of the Police Department, and directions of the operations came under Daniel Mahoney of CCS and a Mr. Essard Birch of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. The squad's intention was to create a situation at the convention which would permit the president to invoke special emergency powers leading to the arrest of political activists and throughout the country. The squad planned to use explosives inside the convention hall to kill prominent politicians and journalists attending the convention. Again, the lawsuit of the Christig Institute is about blowing up a group of journalists and killing three of them, two who survived, and aiming to get rid of these particular people that were opposing the operations of the Contras and create an excuse for more money for the Contras. So what they were planning in 71 and what they did before and after, the similarities are there because it's the same people who really never have left power. The squad, as I say, would use explosives and blow up journalists and politicians. Louis Tack would realize that the small fry in San Diego, the Lee Harvey Oswalds, would be killed. He'd never get out alive. Agents were to be hired to infiltrate groups planning demonstrations against the war and against Nixon and Agnew. And at the same time the explosives go off inside the convention hall, there would simultaneously be riots in the streets, just as the same people who killed John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy planned riots when Martin Luther King was killed. And that was the excuse to clamp down on violent black activists, for one thing, and escalate mind control and brain surgery and isolate the blacks for violence because of violence at that particular time. Tankwood said the goal was a total police state, and after martial law, they were figuring out a way to get Nixon. He was approached in September 71. He held his press conference October 18th to tell about Squad 19, and you can look that up. It was in the Washington Post, written by Leroy Ahrens, Los Angeles Times, the LA Free Press, the New York Times. In 1971, those papers were available, and I think that the congressional committees, the Congress, is going to have a full vote on the Rehnquist nomination to be Chief Justice. So, number one, what I'm saying is write a letter and ask for the Louis Tackwood allegations and what Rehnquist did about them. You can go to the library and copy his press conferences. All of that is indexed in the library, and you can photocopy it and ask what William Rehnquist did know about that. He left in 1971 then to be appointed as a justice of the Supreme Court, but the plans that were made while he was still working as a legal advisor, chief advisor for the Justice Department. And the excuse for all of this was that there were security leaks out of the Pentagon Papers, and Eagle Crow was to plug the leaks. As Howard Hunt of the CIA was brought into the White House, G. Gordon Liddy of the FBI and a special prosecutor from upstate New York was brought into the White House, and this committee was working not only on the Pentagon Papers, but the Chappaquiddick story in case Ted Kennedy would win the nomination or to keep him from getting it, and they were interfering with the elections. So the allegations of Louis Tackwood involved activity that was being planned in the fall of 71, espionage squad that involved Herbert Kalmbach in California, martial law plans, emergency contingency unit, the use of the police force in Miami working along with the FBI and also in San Diego before the convention was switched to Miami. That happened a little later in the spring of 72. The work of the Los Angeles Police Department with the National Intelligence and the State Intelligence, all linked nationally to the police in each individual state and in Washington. The conspiracies would be up and down the coast. It involved Houston, Texas headquarters, Dallas to spread around, and public relations offices, and the hiring of radicals and provocateurs. The fund that was earmarked for the project was $10 million. The contact men were Martin and White, who later turned out Martin and White were the aliases given of James McCord and E. Howard Hunt when they signed in, were arrested at the time of Watergate. And the overall plan was, after martial law, to get Nixon and blame the radicals. Now, that was in 1971 that this was printed in all the newspapers. And at that time that the plans were being made, Rehnquist, as I say, had this job as chief legal advisor for the Justice Department. Now, Robert Gilmore from the Houston Post wrote an article which I saw similar to other people have written on the fact that the president does not have the right to name and decide on the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The article from the Post says the Senate should act as a full partner in naming the justices, not just the Senate judiciary. And Robert Gilmore says this: the Senate, if they have an idea of the way they're going to vote the Supreme Court later on, the way they want to keep homosexuals and the sodomy case in the minds of people, follow the nominations of Antonio Scalia and William Rehnquist, and you get an idea of what is happening. Both nominees believe that the Supreme Court must always defer to the political processes, whether they trample on politically defenseless minorities or not. For both the nominees, they believe they defer to the political process, which is whoever is in power, I suppose. Unfortunately, Gilmore writes, nearly everyone is laboring under a delusion that the president, and only the president, can choose the ideology of a judicial nominee. Everyone knows, for example, that Reagan administration carefully picks judges to suit its ideological taste. But when any senator appears to object to that taste, Reagan cries foul. And many senators say Reagan is right. When they oppose a nominee, they insist it's not because of his ideology, but his competence. I am sorry, Gilmore writes, but on this matter, almost everyone is wrong. There is no warrant in law or logic for saying that a president can pick a judge because of his judicial philosophy, but that the Senate cannot. About judicial nominations, Article 2 of the Constitution says only that the president shall nominate, and by and with advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint judges of the Supreme Court. The Constitution is utterly silent on the criteria the president or the Senate may or may not use when nominating or confirming judges. The Constitution does make the executive, legislative, and judicial branches co-equal. That means, for example, there is no constitutional reason to give the president any more power over judicial appointments than the Senate. On the contrary, the president and the Senate have equal power in that each has to say yes to the nominee to make it an appointment. The equality of the presidential and senatorial appointment power is confirmed by the history of the drafting of the Constitution. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention disagreed on whether the president or Senate would make a better appointment. So instead of giving the appointment power to one or the other, they gave it to both. In fact, at least a few delegates thought this compromise was ideal, because it gave the Senate a check on the president. The co-equality of the judiciary also makes it impossible to argue that a president has a right to choose a judge, and it's the same as his right to choose, say, a cabinet secretary or an ambassador. Nearly everyone agrees that a president has a right to have his own people running the executive branch, because the president is, according to the Constitution, in charge of that branch. But the president is not in charge of the judiciary, and any claim that a president has a right to appoint his judges is pure smoke. As I say, I've seen other articles on this subject, and people say, well, if Ronald Reagan is a conservative, he has a right to have a conservative in office, but does not have a right to have a conservative who wants the Constitution erased, who wants martial law, who works with dirty tricks and money for foul activities to hamper other people's prospects or to sabotage information about himself that would be available to other people and hurt those people. And one I'm thinking in particular is Senator Ed Muskie, and I'll get to that in a few moments. Now, in 1964, there were a lot of articles on nationwide police spying in the 60s, and it was documented after court orders on the Red Squad in Chicago and in 33 states and in New York City, Yonkers, New Rochelle, Nassau, Suffolk County, Buffalo, Ithaca, New York State Police, the Civil Service, National Goals and Corporation, and so forth. Now, these groups of Red Squads were linked to Tony Lasowitz. He was involved at Chappaquiddick. He was there the night of the accident when Mary Jo Kopechne was drowned. These involved the Red Squads literally in California when Reagan was governor. And when Rehnquist was, when he was working for the government from 1969 to 71, this activity was still going on, and he was the legal advisor. There was an article that came out on the Chicago Red Squads, written by Barbara Blumenthal. There was a suit filed to ban political spying of Chicago police in 33 states. Again, these suits get quieted down. In 1977, a federal judge ordered the police department to turn over their files and agencies of 26 states, 17 public and private agencies that were spied upon. And the important thing, again, is that the time period for these particular spying operations went up to 1971 and started in the 60s. The files run from 1964 to 1975, when the Red Squad, a unit of the department's intelligence division, was then disbanded in 1975. But Justice Rehnquist was chief legal advisor from 1969 to 1971, where the White House had hired Tony Laskowitz and G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt to work. Laskowitz was a very important part of the operations in the White House, and the Squad 19 that Lewis Tackwood was talking about in 1971. And all of this was the time when Rehnquist was the legal advisor, chief legal advisor to the president, President Nixon, and to John Mitchell, and Robert Martin, and G. Gordon Liddy, and so forth. He served in the Justice Department as their legal advisor when the spying was going on. They spied illegally the government and the Pentagon, the CIA, the FBI, on civil rights groups, anti-war groups, mainstream groups such as League of Women Voters, and there were a large list, I think 150 organizations that were listed in the ACLU suit against the Western goals that has not gone to trial of taking away people's rights that involved the military and surreptitiously taking information about people and then putting it into the computers, and $100,000 computer in the basement of Detective Paul. And, of course, that article I wrote on Larry Flint on why he was murdered had to do for Larry Flint on Larry McDonald, Representative Larry McDonald, of the also president of the Birch Society. The article I wrote in 1983 had to do October 83, and it was published in February of 84 in Hustler. It took 2 months for the legal department, or three, to actually clear it. There were so many names in that suit. But everything that I wrote in that matter has to do with time periods that involve William Rehnquist working for the Justice Department. And these files were going not only to Western goals, but to the military, to people like John Singlaub, who's now a defendant in the suit placed by Christic Institute. Part of Western goals, the late Roy Cohn, who just died of AIDS last week, and Admiral Thomas Moore, and the very highest of the Pentagon. This information was going to the Pentagon and to the John Birch Society and other organizations for dirty tricks. And this material, as I say, was being accumulated and put into computers. And while William Rehnquist, was working for Richard Nixon, he was part of the legal advice of people that were doing illegal activities, and now he should be promoted to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. There's an article out of the Houston Post, December 6, 1984, on the Houston Police Department working. It was one of more than 100 agencies that traded information with Chicago Red Squad and their involvement in Houston, Texas, and of course the major cities all over America were involved with this Red Squad activity that continued on and stopped in 1977, when Rehnquist was still in charge of the legal department, as this information was filing into Washington, into the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover didn't die until May of 72, but the FBI was heavily involved in blackmail and in crimes in the COINTEL program, in the Operation Chaos program, and William Rehnquist was very much in the middle of that in Washington, D.C., when he was made a judge on the Supreme Court. The Watergate story hadn't yet broken out around the country. There are quite a few articles from December 1984. If you go to your library and look them up, December the 6th on the 60s Police Spy Network covered the entire United States. That's one from the San Jose Mercury, December the 6th, 1984. The same December 6, 84, Los Angeles Times. California agencies got dossiers on non-criminal groups from the Chicago police, and these were spread around all the states of the Union. They said 33, but with computers, it could go much faster, and I'm sure a lot of people are aware of the computers that the Aryan Nations have, run by Richard Butler, who worked at Lockheed on the U2 program in Burbank, and then became a minister up in Hayden Lake, Idaho, where he wants to separate the whites from blacks in the United States, and is part of a plan to kill all blacks and Jews in the United States, and they're quite overt about that. So Rehnquist had an active part in that. Now, the physical condition of Rehnquist is very interesting. Many of you might be reading the material about his doctor and the care that he got and the hypnosis drugs he got right after he became a justice of the Supreme Court. Now, I did a program on the death, the suicide of Senator East a few weeks ago, and since then there's been some other material that came out. His suicide note wasn't made available for several weeks, and it's perfectly obvious that the reason the suicide note was hidden for so long, his death was described in the newspapers at June 28, 1986, that time period. But it took 1 month to tell about the suicide note because the doctor he blames for his death is the doctor that was drugging William Rehnquist with hypnosis drugs three times the normal dose and more frequently for a longer period of time, three times longer than the period of time, till he actually had a drug dependency. And that is a very nice hook to put on a justice of the Supreme Court who from then on will, if he didn't before, be dancing to your tunes. The article from the LA Times, Senator John East, a wheelchair-bound polio victim, prided himself on his mental acumen. He wrote a note before killing himself. He blamed his doctor. He blamed Bethesda Naval Hospital and Dr. Freeman H. Carey, the attending physician of Congress, who failed to detect his thyroid disease, which sapped his energy and gave him the wrong medications, which led to a near-fatal coma last year, which affected and ruined his health. And because of this terrible condition, he didn't want to live any longer. Carey, a rear admiral in the Navy Reserves, was one of the doctors who treated East for his thyroid condition that was diagnosed after he went into a coma. And Carey was released from his post that he had for 13 years, 1 month after East died. Then the articles began about Rehnquist had drug dependency, and it tells about his dependency of a hypnotic drug from 1977 to 1981 that he was given, even before he was, well, 1971 was when he was nominated to the court, so it's while he was on the court, 1977 to 1981, frequently using a three-month prescription. In a single month, Dr. Freeman Carey, the Capitol physician who prescribed the drug Placidil, for the Chief Justice designate told the FBI that he warned Rehnquist on occasion about exceeding the recommended dosage. Dr. William Polin, former director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, was not allowed to talk to Rehnquist, and he wasn't allowed to talk to Carey or the pharmacist at the Capitol who filled the prescription. He based his studies primarily on Rehnquist's medical records for Congress and didn't go into the mental records. Carey, the sources say, Dr. Carey began prescribing Placidil for Rehnquist in 1971 to help him sleep despite severe back pains. But this isn't a sleeping pill. The report told the FBI that Rehnquist had taken it before, I guess before Dr. Carey prescribed it, probably before he was even on the bench. According to the authoritative physician's desk reference, prolonged use of the drug may result in tolerance and psychological and physical dependence. The usual adult dosage of Placidil is 500 milligrams. Taken orally at bedtime, Rehnquist was consuming 1,500 milligrams, running a three-month prescription to a one-month time, and packing those into his body. And they're described as hypnosis drugs, and that he was dependent upon them. And then he was put into the hospital and had to have treatment for withdrawing. The Los Angeles Times had a story August 12th, from the Washington Post, a repeat Carey, a cardiologist, joined the office of the attending physicians in 1972 and became head of the office in 1973. The office, established in 1928, treats members of Congress, their families, staffs, pages, Capitol Police, provides emergency treatment for tourists. Supreme Court justices are all entitled to free medical care. And so this poor Rehnquist, I don't know what his mind was before, and Senator East had the same physician, East blaming him for the reason for his death, and at the same time we're getting a man nominated as the head of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, who is taking this kind of medication and has been under hypnosis drugs and has taken large amounts of the medication, and goodness knows what happened to him in this interim or who was in touch with him, because they describe it as a hypnotic drug. The San Francisco Chronicle said that Dr. Freeman H. Carey, until recently, attending physician for Congress had prescribed these drugs, and Rehnquist was at George Washington Hospital in 1981 to help him withdraw from the drug. He had disturbances in mental clarity and had to withdraw, and evidently has deep problems. The drug has nothing to do with the pain in his back, but it is, as is described, as a hypnotic drug and makes you sleep, but it also is a hypnotic drug. We'll take a one-minute break and go back, go back to the story of William Rehnquist and some very important information about him and his nomination as the future Justice of the Supreme Court.